Given the USA has approximately 60 times the population of New Zealand, closer to 100 times actually, can New Zealand's experience be applicable to the US? I get asked that question a lot. And my answer to it is yes, because the principles that we applied are not dictated to by the size of the operation. The principle of only funding things that work is pretty basic, and it should apply everywhere. The principle of looking for solutions rather than supporting problems is pretty basic and should apply anywhere. The principle of holding people in government service accountable for results is pretty basic. All of those things are basic. Is it more difficult to do here? The answer is yes. For a start, your form of government makes it more difficult. Parliamentary systems mean that those elected to office are extremely powerful. We used to have cabinet meetings every Monday morning. And the difference with parliamentary systems and cabinet government is that you're involved in all of the decisions for every department. And we knew that if we made a decision on Monday morning, we could do it. We could get the legislation through the House. We could vote the monies. We could actually start to do the job. We could do it. Here, if the President makes a decision, it's problematic. Even if his party owns both the Senate and the Congress as to whether or not they'll support him on it. So it's pretty problematic. So we made change by revolution. You have to make change by evolution. Now, the good thing about your system is that your politicians have not been able to screw your country up as badly as ours did. That's encouraging. But when you've got problems, they're harder to fix. So, yes, there is a difference, and the difference, in my view, is not the size, it's the governing system. How much union, in brackets, teachers' opposition was there? How much inertia? How do you overcome it? Why would...
That's five questions.
Why would trial lawyers, the NEA unions, want to change? And if they don't want to, how do you make them? The union question's an interesting one because people say to me, well, you know, we've got problems with unions. Through the entire period of making this change, New Zealand was a country that had compulsory unionism. So at every level, everybody belonged to a union in one form or another. And as we went through this change, we never used the power of the Parliament to overturn people's terms and conditions of employment or their contracts. We negotiated our way through them. But it's interesting that you can negotiate your way through difficult things. You have to be hard-nosed about it, but you can be fair and you can make progress. You see, lots of people in the United States probably thought that Ronald Reagan was crazy when he fired the air traffic controllers, and that he was going to have a huge problem because nobody had ever challenged the union movement. But it probably had the greatest disciplinary effect on the union movement of any action taken in the United States in the preceding 50 years and the years since. Not only did it have that impact in the United States, it had it around the rest of the world as well. Now you add to that Maggie Thatcher and the coal miners, where she said to the coal miners, go out on strike if you like. In fact, I don't care if you never go back to work. And what the coal miners didn't realize was that England was no longer dependent totally on coal. In fact, I saw something about 3 or 4 weeks ago that the last striking Welsh coal miner died. So some of them did stay out. But those two things started to make the rest of us realize that it was wrong for unions to hold countries to ransom, and it was possible to deal with hard problems and to make progress on them. Now, on the other side of that, Ronald Reagan did exactly the same with communism and with the Soviet Union. He called them on it. Nobody else had been prepared to do it before, and it was successful as a result. I put those things down as strong leadership, and that if you get strong leadership, you'll find that people come out and support you. What they don't want to do is to support you and find that you capitulate halfway through. If you're going to do something, then you've got to be seen to be able to follow it through. Why would trial lawyers, the NEA, unions want to change? The answer is that most of them don't want to change. But if you can find a cohort of people that are bigger than they are and that support what you're doing, then they have to capitulate. Now, when we were doing education reforms, the teacher unions, which was the largest, was very much opposed. But as they saw what we were doing, particularly handing control of the schools over to the parents, and the parents were excited and enthusiastic about it, in the end they said to the other unions, "You're on your own because we can't win this battle, we're pulling out." And we won that one. So it's a matter of looking for where you can find support bases that are as great or greater than those that are challenging you. What is the taxing structure in New Zealand? Federal, sales, local, etc. We totally reformed the tax system in 1987, and it was one of the things where we rewrote the law. And it looked pretty much like yours up until that time. I think you've got 35,000 pages now in the code. We had 12,000 pages. But what was fundamentally wrong with it, in our view, was that it was designed... it was being used to do things that it wasn't well equipped to use. Governments need revenue. And the people have ceded to governments the right to tax as a means of gathering the revenue. But over time, what we've used those same systems to do is to try and deliver social policy with them, to try and deliver incentives with them, to try and change behaviour, and to gather revenue. Now, every time you add those other things into it, you screw it up. And you make it more and more complex and more difficult and less just. So what we did in the end was to decide that we were going to totally change the taxation system and that we were going to base it upon the role of the taxation system was to raise revenue. Finish. We would deliver social policy differently. And what we were going to do was pay money directly to people that wanted it or needed it rather than doing it by concessions in the tax code. And that's because you can control and target payments better than you can control deductions. Because smart lawyers and accountants find ways of including people that you never wanted to be in there in the first instance. And the lawyer will always make an application for you, whereas if you had to go along and ask the government for the money in many instances, you wouldn't go. So there were lots of reasons. What we had was a system that looked very much like yours. And what we changed it to do was to look at what will make the New Zealand economy more competitive and what will encourage investment to come into New Zealand and what will make people less apprehensive about the taxation system as a whole. So we decided that we would base it on gathering revenue, that there would only be two means of gathering revenue, a tax on income and a tax on consumption, that we would abolish all of the sales taxes, we'd abolish all of the excise duties, we'd abolish all of the death duties, capital gains taxes and all of those things. We'd abolish all of those things. And the reform system was to gather as much revenue as the one that we had previously. And that we would try and keep the tax rate as flat as possible. We looked at making the tax on income a flat tax and decided against it in the end because our highest rate of tax before the reform was 66% and you got there at relatively low income. And the lowest rate was 38% and you had people who were quite poor who were paying 38%. What we did, and it had five steps in the scale, what we did in the end was to say, if we went to a flat tax, it would be a rate of 24%. That was the number. That meant that people on high income got a very large reduction, and people on lower income got much less of a reduction. We decided that that probably wouldn't last because it would be seen to be unfair. So what we did was that we halved the top rate of tax from 66 to 33, and we halved the bottom rate of tax from 38 to 19. Everybody pays tax on every dollar earned. And to people on low income, we make compensation for that by giving them direct payments. For example, there used to be deductions that you could make for a family and children. Now, what happens if you do that is that Jerome puts in his tax return, he gets the deduction. But if, for example, as we did in our case, we decide that you're entitled to so much money per child, and this used to be $12.50 a child that you were allowed as a compensation, if you targeted that, you could also determine that you would pay it to the caregiver. So what we took was all of the money that we gave away in tax deductions before on family benefit, and we said we'll divide this evenly, but you lose it as you get towards the average income for some compensation for the size of your family. Instead of it being $12.50 per child, that meant that it was $48 for the first child and $37 per child after that, every week. But it was paid to the caregiver, so women in the main got it. And it was cash that they never ever had before. And that was actually very effective. The wage earner didn't miss it, because it'd never been there before. But now there was cash in the hands of the person who was in the main raising the children. That's how you can actually use social policy more productively and also control it better by making direct payments. The interesting thing was that having gone through this process of reducing tax rates and very carefully done the calculations so that it was revenue neutral, we wouldn't get any more revenue or less revenue than we did previously. In the first year we got 20% more revenue. And the answer was that you got lots of voluntary compliance. You brought people out of the black economy. You had people who would do more, actually earn more money at low tax rates, who would at 66% said, why bother? It's not worth going to work for what's left, the 34 cents in the dollar. So a lot of things, plus repatriation of monies, meant that we got more revenue. One of the interesting phenomena that I track is that cutting tax rates in the main produces more revenue. Quite the reverse of what your politicians say. The Irish cut their capital gains tax 3 years ago from 42% down to 27% and got 40% more revenue. Voluntary compliance. Investments coming in that previously didn't pay taxes in that environment. The Russians 3 years ago converted their whole of their revenue system to a flat tax, which I think is 13%. And they used to range as high as, it was up in the 60s at the high end, but in the main it was somewhere around 30%. 3 years later, they're getting 79% more revenue from that flat tax than they were from the other system. So there's some major opportunities in my view and looking carefully at how you handle taxes. Now, the last thing that was good about that was that by just having two mechanisms, we had so simplified the tax code that everybody on wages and salaries no longer had to file tax returns. And that meant that 64% of the population didn't have to file tax returns any longer. You could if you thought the government owed you money. You didn't have to file one if you thought you owed them money. And the reason we did that was that when you went through the exercise of looking at auditing tax returns for wage and salary earners, it cost us $4 for every $3 we got back. That was pretty stupid. Right. Now, one of the interesting debates that occurred in Parliament was this, that what we were doing was knowingly allowing some people to get away with cheating on their income tax. And a lot of members of Parliament were pretty upset about that, because when we went to the Revenue Department, we said of how much revenue isn't collected from wage and salary earners, and they said it's somewhere around about 2.5% to 3%. How much of that is deliberate and how much of it is accidental? Well, half of it was accidental. People just made mistakes. So that's not really worth worrying about. How much of it was deliberate fraud? About 0.75%. So you get down to the argument, are you going to screw up everybody else because of 0.75%? And the answer was, please don't screw up everybody else for 0.75%. The interesting thing also about that is that since that was initiated in 1987, there has been no significant change to that tax policy position. That's the longest period of time in our history we've ever gone without a significant revision of the tax system. The revenues continue to grow. Okay. What is the role of the government in the protection of the environment? The answer to that one is that we, like everybody else, have laws that are designed to protect the environment. The unfortunate thing with the initial stages of public consciousness about environmental issues is that we started from a punitive approach, that there were lots of bad people out there doing bad things. That was true when you looked at point of origin discharges and things like that, but they were relatively easily controlled. More and more what we're doing is moving towards how can you create incentives that will improve stewardship. And in a number of areas, we have used property rights as a means of being able to do that. For example, for the whole of the fishery, we created something that's called an individual transferable right. But as a fisherman, I would own 10% of the haddock that could be caught in that fishery. There is a certain quantity that's allowed to be caught, that's the sustainable yield, but 10% of that is mine to catch. Nobody else can catch it. But if the health of the fishery improves, my 10% instead of being 100 tonnes might be 120 tonnes or 130 tonnes. I have a very strong incentive to see that the base stock isn't harmed. And there's two countries around the world that have moved down that course, Iceland and New Zealand, and they're the only two that have significant recovery in their fisheries. And what you're really doing is that you're creating incentives for better stewardship. We did the same with forests, and we did the same with the use of water and a number of those things. But how can you find a way in which it serves my best interest as the user to be conscious of what's the best interest of the resource? And it's possible to do that by incentives. It also means that you don't have to be as overbearing as you might otherwise have been. And now, still got the one I can't read. Tort law. Tort law in New Zealand is relatively insignificant because a long time ago, in fact back in 1974, we had a social trade-off, and it was built around the fact that a significant number of people got hurt from time to time and they weren't insured, and therefore they had no protection. Maybe the health system would look after some of their problems because we have a public health system, but they were left sort of out on their own. And at the same time, on the other side, we had tort lawyers that were starting to get large settlements for certain individuals in court cases. So we had a major national debate about it, and we went into a trade-off with the public. And the trade-off was that you will be covered for all accidents at all times, but you lose the right to sue. And that coverage works on the basis of, for accidents at work, your employer is paying the premium. Out of your wages and salaries comes the premium that pays for your accidents that occur in non-work-related situations. And for people who are non-earners, have disabilities, or on welfare, then the government pays the premium for them. So tort law is not the problem that it is here. Barbara, my wife, and I think that just as we use your health system, our guess is that diagnosis here costs about four times as much in New Zealand because of the doctor's fear of being sued. We've had more MRIs since we've been in the United States than our whole family has ever had in the past, just in case something might go wrong. And I think that's a problem that you have, that the level of caution that's being promoted by tort settlements is driving people to go to ridiculous ends to avoid the potential of a case. Did I miss anybody's question? Because I've sort of got some of the things. Or what here? How did the new paradigm in New Zealand affect its healthcare system? And what would work in the United States? For a long period of time, New Zealand's had a public health system and a private health system. And it works on the basis of everybody has an absolute entitlement to use the public health system at any time, regardless of income or anything like that. It's met for, it's met out of your general tax revenues, and the health care is pretty good. We also have a private health care system where people buy insurance. All that the insurance does is guarantee you earlier treatment for what the doctors euphemistically call non-life-threatening problems, which means that you might need a five-way bypass, but the doctor doesn't think you're going to die tomorrow, so you go on a waiting list. So a lot of people buy health insurance because of that. In my case, I never bought health insurance, but whenever our family needed something done, we just paid for it to get the early treatment. It was cheaper than buying the health insurance. We have some of the same problems that you have, and they are very perplexing. When I was in Cabinet, we were making some major changes to the health system, and one of them was to try and deal with some of these issues of queuing. If you wanted a hip replacement, it might take you 2 years, or if you wanted a heart bypass, it could take you anywhere from a month to 2.5 years, depending how serious the doctor thought it was. Now, one of the things that we did was to look at hip replacements, and we quadrupled the amount of money that we put into hip replacements, and we didn't reduce the queue. And whatever it is, when you say five times, we did that for heart bypass, and we didn't reduce the queue. Now, I don't think people had more troubles with their hips, but there was something going on in the medical profession that said that people were getting sent for these procedures against a different criteria now that it was more readily available. Don't know how you deal with that overuse situation. What would work in the United States? I think that the biggest problem that you have and we have is that the process, whether it's public or private, has separated the consumer of healthcare from the process of paying. And because we don't have to pay for it, we consider it to be a free good. And because it's a free good, we use it, even if we're just bored for the day and we want to do something. What would help, in my view, would be this. If instead of the employer negotiating with the HMO for insurance coverage for all of the employees, employers paid to their employees the equivalent of the premium and said, go buy your own health care. Now all of a sudden you would have a very serious interest in terms of, is this the deal that works best for me? And how much does it cost me? And how may I contain some of those costs? Is it likely to happen? Don't think so, because both the health professionals and the HMOs like what they have now. But what you've got in HMOs and PPOs and all of those strange alphabet names is bureaucracies in the private sector that perform exactly the same as bureaucracies in the public sector. And the person who doesn't really count in the equation is the patient. Until those things are addressed, I think that we're going to stumble round on healthcare. But my solution would be move the consumer closer to the paying process and you'll get changes in behavior. That's the questions. Unless I missed somebody's. Did I miss anybody? Okay, thank you.